Okay, if you would open up your Bibles to Genesis chapter 37. We've been going through the book of Genesis for some time now, so made our way finally to the 37th chapter. If you remember here over the last few chapters, we have Jacob as he spent some time in Padan Aram, you know, looking for a wife and escaping the wrath of his brother. He met his wife Rachel and Leah and then the concubines that come along with that, and he ends up having 11 children when he actually leaves Padan Aram, coming back to meet his brother. He runs into his brother in the small town of Succoth. You know, the thing he was concerned about the most turned out to be no big deal. So his brother heads south back to Seir. He heads west, or he actually heads just a little bit west and kind of stays outside the land. Doesn't necessarily go where he had intended on going the whole time. Doesn't actually enter the land of Canaan. He stays on the outside of Canaan. Then he finally enters the land of Canaan, buys some land in a little town called Shechem outside the city. That turned out to be a lot of trouble for his family. We read that in, I think, the 35th chapter as a terrible episode. Then he finally made his way on down toward Bethel. And now he's actually not even quite there. Now he's actually in Hebron when we run into him today. But Jacob seems to have taken the long way home. And it seems that finally, we're finally back in the land. We're finally back in the land that God had promised Abram, that God had promised to Isaac, and God had even promised to him. But I think we've kind of forgotten something. You know, when God made that promise to Abram, he said something that I believe we've forgotten. I've forgotten, and I may have taught the chapter. So if you would, turn back to chapter 15. God says this. It just kind of stuck out because there's a lot going on behind the scenes in this chapter today. Genesis chapter 15, you know, Abram had again asked for, you know, questioned God, like, God, I still don't have an offspring. You promised this land to me and I still don't have an offspring. And God had kind of reaffirmed the promise to him. Can you count the stars, Abram? That's going to be your descendants. You're going to have as many descendants as the stars. And then he goes in verse 12 of chapter 15. As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram. And behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. Then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain. So if the Lord tells you to know something for certain, you kind of take that to the bank, can't you? Know this for certain, that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, will be slaves there. They will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterwards they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. So there's going to be a period of time there when he shows them the land, but they're not going to possess it. He's going to send them into a foreign land, a land that's not theirs, and they're going to be slaves there. We know now that's the land of Egypt he's referring to. And they're there for 400 years. God brings judgment on Egypt. They leave Egypt with the whole Exodus, you know, where the Passover, the parting of the Red Sea, everything that goes on there, they leave there with many possessions, just like the Lord had told them. But he also tells them why they're going to be in Egypt. One of the reasons why is because the sin or the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. We're told why. Their sin has not yet reached its boiling point. So the Lord, in his patience, is even given 400 years for the Amorites to repent, to change course. And they don't do it. They still worship foreign gods, reject the true God. And so then when God brings Israelite back and gives them their land and they destroy them, he uses Israel to destroy the Amorites. He's just in doing so. There's just a whole lot going on. So we know why. And in this chapter, chapter 37 today, we're actually going to see how. Well, how are they going to get to Egypt? Well, we see the wheels are kind of set in motion today. This is how it's going to happen. Joseph's going to be sold into slavery. Joseph's going to be sent ahead to preserve life. Man, there's just so much going on behind the scenes. And if you don't see the sovereignty of God in this chapter, it's because you're intentionally overlooking it. I thought about that as Todd was preaching in his sermon in Luke, how God's sovereign hand was working in the affairs of the life of Christ and the death of Christ at the cross. It's everywhere, guys, but it's here. It's obvious here. It's woven throughout this whole account. And the Lord just masterfully works all this out. Well, the title of this sermon is, I Have a Dream. And that's taken from verse 5 and verse 8. You know, in Martin Luther King's famous I Have a Dream speech, he spoke of equality. Joseph's dream was more about being elevated above his brothers. So there's a contrast in that. But there's some things, before we get into this, some things we need to focus on in this chapter. Some things that kind of just keep popping up. One thing is the coat, Jacob's coat of many colors that almost everyone here is familiar with. If you went to a Sunday school class, I think our kids actually colored one the other day. So the coat of many color, or the robe as it's called here, which is just a symbol of Joseph being favored, his dreams, both of which show him ruling over his brothers, and hate. Those are three key themes in this. Look in verse 4. And we're going to read this, so don't panic. But in verse 4, at the end of verse 4, it says what? They hated him. Talking about Joseph. They hated Joseph and could not speak peaceably to him. Look in verse 5. What it says, they hated him even more. They heaped hate on top of hate. Verse 8. At the end of verse 8. So they hated him even more for his dreams. And then it just goes on in verse 11. It says they were jealous of him. They were envious of him. So we see this hate, as it begins to build, it's going to find an opportunity to lash out. So let's pick up. I'll read the first couple of verses here. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. So the phrase in verse 2, these are the generations of Jacob. This phrase indicates we're entering a new section. And this section is going to carry us on through the remainder of Genesis. Jacob is going to remain a major figure throughout, but Joseph in his story, or the account, will become the focus. And it's likely here that it says he was with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. So it's likely that Joseph's mother, who had died, so when his mother died, likely Joseph fell under the care of his mother's handmaiden, Bilhah. Most commentators think that when his mother had died, that he would be raised in the tent of his mother's servant, Bilhah. So it's no surprise here that he's with Bilhah, the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And it says he brought a bad report of them. So it seems as if he brought a bad report. And we know from verse 14, I don't know that Joseph's necessarily a tattletale. That's the first, knee-jerk reaction. Man, he's just like a little tattletale, isn't he? But when you get to verse 14, it shows that Jacob actually asked his son Joseph to bring back a report. Go check on your brothers, check on the flocks, and report back to me. So it seems as if Joseph was someone who could be trusted. He gave his father an honest report. And the report Joseph gave of his brothers was not favorable. Wasn't favorable at all. So then we read in verse 3. Now Israel, that's Jacob, loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was a son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. He was favored. He was the pick. And it's just hard to imagine how Jacob could do this. I mean, it's common today. It's something we can fall prey to. But it's hard to imagine Jacob was raised in a house that showed favoritism. You know, back in chapter 25, we read that Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. But Rebekah loved Jacob. That's the same word. Was Jacob trying to imitate the way he was raised? It's not like he was raised in a house full of good memories. I really don't know why he went back down this path. But nonetheless, he shows favoritism toward Joseph, his son, because he was the son of his old age. Now, casual reading of that, you think, well, you know, he was old when he had Joseph. Joseph was the 11th son. He was the first son that he had with Rachel, whom was his, I guess, most precious wife, the wife he loved the most. But Benjamin was born at this time, and Benjamin was considerably younger than Joseph. And to be fair, Benjamin is described in this exact same way in Genesis 44, as a son of his old age. A commentator by the name of Jameson Fawcett Brown says this, quote, "This is simply a Hebrew phrase for a wise son, one who possessed observation and wisdom above his years, an old head on young shoulders," unquote. So what Jameson Fawcett Brown seems to think, that this is just a Hebrew phrase that is similar to us saying today, he's wise beyond his years. Joseph's wise beyond his years. He's the son of an old age. Maybe that's it. In the coming chapters, we're going to see the wisdom of Joseph. You know, the wisdom of how he handles things in Egypt. God was with him, but still he acted in with much wisdom. And although he's second to the youngest, his wisdom and maturity at this point being only 17, it does seem to exceed that of his brothers. Four brothers received a bad report, as if they waited till they got outside the careful, watchful eye of their brother and then just goofed off. So four of them received a bad report. Two of them led in a murder plot and murdered all the males in Shechem. One of them committed incest. So it's not like they set the bar real high. But anyway, he has this son of his old age, most likely a wise son, one with much wisdom, one that he could be trusted to oversee things. And he made him a robe of many colors. Now this phrase or word, robe of many colors, is only used in two places. It's used three times here, and it's used twice in another place, but it's really only used on two accounts. In 2 Samuel 13, you don't have to turn there, but if you remember when we were going through that, this is where David has a son named Amnon, and he has a daughter named Tamar. Amnon rapes his sister Tamar. It talks about this. It says, "Now she," Tamar, "was wearing a long robe with sleeves." That's how the same word's translated over there. Not a coat or a robe of many colors, but rather a long robe with sleeves. Again, Albert Barnes, a commentator, said that this was a coat reaching to the hands or the feet. It was worn by persons not much occupied with manual labor, according to the general opinion. So the general opinion of what this word means is it was a coat that would stretch all the way to the feet, go to the hands, and it was worn by people in charge. Seems to be a role that Joseph would fit well. He was wiser. He seems to be the one bringing back reports to his father. So whether this is a coat or a robe of many colors, or whether it's a long sleeve robe, or maybe it's a combination of both, maybe it's long sleeve and colorful, we don't know. But something was special, something was unique, that we know. And this coat or this robe was a sign of his father's favor. His favoritism isn't hidden. It's actually worn as a symbol. And it says, when his brothers saw, verse 4, "But when his brothers saw that their father loved him," Joseph, "more than all his brothers, they hated him." They hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. They couldn't even speak kindly to him. They hated him so much. Then verse 5. Now Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. Joseph said to them in verse 6, "Hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. And behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaf gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Look, there's no question what the interpretation of the dream means. They got it. and it infuriated them. They hated him to start with, now they hate him even more. They heap hate upon hate. But he doesn't stop there. He just gives this dream, and almost in some kind of arrogant, boastful attitude, "Hey guys, behold, I had a dream. Hear this dream that I've dreamed." And then he tells them the dream of how they're going to bow down to him. He's going to reign and rule over them. But he doesn't stop there. Verse 9. Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I've dreamed another dream. The sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and to his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. So again, another dream, same interpretation. They all get it. Nobody's real happy about it. They're hating them. They're hating them, and this hatred has turned into envy or jealousy here. But the way Joseph presents this, "Behold the dream that I have dreamed. Behold, I have dreamed another dream." You know, it's I. It, like I said, it gives the impression that Joseph is just telling these dreams to his family in some kind of boastful way. It really does. Now, when it comes to Joseph in the dreams in Egypt, we see a different Joseph. He gives all the credit to God. When we read about him interpreting dreams in Egypt, the one with the baker and the one with Pharaoh, it's all the credit goes to God. But you don't really see God mentioned here. It's hey, I'm going to be elevated. You're going to be bowing down to me. Probably all the while he's wearing that coat that already shows his love of the father more than theirs. So here we see a 17-year-old. What seems to be an in-your-faith attitude with his dreams and his robe. So they hate him even more. And his father says something that's a little bit puzzling here. He says, "Shall I and your mother bow down to you?" Well, his mother was dead. Rachel had passed away at this point. So most likely, the sun, the moon, and the stars really means Jacob, his wives, his children, the whole family. Sun, the moon, stars, we're all going to bow down to you, Jacob, Joseph. I knew I was going to do that. I've probably already done it 20 times so far. You just have to kind of work with me on that. But his brothers were jealous of him. They were envious of him. But again, why did he dream? They got the interpretation in the first dream, so what's the point of the second dream? What's the point of the second dream? Why did he dream another dream? Why two dreams? Look with me in chapter 41 of Genesis. Chapter 41, Joseph has been in prison. He's been brought out of prison. He's going to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. Pharaoh's going to have two dreams. One dream is going to consist of seven cows. One dream consists of 7 ears of grain. We'll read this in just a couple of weeks, Lord willing. None of Pharaoh's wise men could interpret these dreams. None. So they go bring Joseph in, and Joseph tells them in verse 25, he tells them, "Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, 'The dreams of Pharaoh are one.'" Talking about both dreams. "God has revealed to Pharaoh what he's about to do. The dreams are one," meaning both the dreams have the same meaning. That's what Joseph said. Look in verse 32. "And the doubling of Pharaoh's dreams," meaning you had two dreams, "the doubling of your dream means that the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it about." So, using Genesis 41 to interpret Genesis 37, the two dreams indicate that this thing is fixed by God. It's certainty, and he's soon going to bring it about. Now, we know Joseph is 17 back in chapter 37 when he's sold into slavery. He's like 30. So that's not that long as God brings this about. And so, it tells us in chapter 42 that this is when his brothers come to Joseph to buy grain. They don't know it's him. It tells us in chapter 2, verse 6, that his brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. And in verse 9, it says, Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed. So Joseph's dreams were fixed by God. They were certain to come to pass, and according to chapter 42, they do. They come to pass soon. So that was a reason for two dreams, if I could use chapter 41 to interpret chapter 37. This thing is fixed by God. There's nothing they're going to be able to do about it, although they try. We'll read that in a minute. Verse 12. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. What are they doing? I mean, Shechem. We just remember what happened there. They murdered all the men of the city and fled there, really in fear. And that's where they go. Right back to Shechem. With all the history at Shechem. You know, again, these are just things you have to wonder. In chapter 36, we read where Esau left Canaan to go to the land of Seir because the land could not support the both of them. So Esau's gone. Shouldn't there be enough, plenty of pasture land around here? Or maybe they ravaged the land at this point. And so Esau goes to Seir, and then you have Joseph's sons here, Jacob's sons, going up to Shechem to pasture the flock. Because they did own some land up there. You know, they had bought some land, if you remember that, from chapter 35. But they traveled 50 miles. It's 50 miles from here to Shechem. 50 miles. Maybe they just really want to escape the eye of authority. Maybe they just wanted to get out. Just get out from under their father's eye. So they go to Shechem. Verse 14. Or 13. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to them, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now and see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me a word." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. So we see right away that they were in Hebron. That's 50 miles from Hebron to Shechem, that Jacob here sends Joseph to check on his brothers. Because Jacob knew full well the history that had happened up there and the dangers that probably were all around them. Although they may have been a little brash in how they went about things and with such a nonchalant attitude. And then we get in verses 15 through 17. And a man found him, being Joseph, wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where are they pasturing the flock?" And the man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. We see Joseph, what, wandering in the fields because he couldn't find his brothers. He's likely concerned, like his father, that the people of Shechem have avenged themselves and killed his brothers. He's wandering in the fields. And finally a man sees him and asks him, "Hey, what are you looking for?" And, "I'm looking for my brothers. Please, please tell me where they are." Joseph learns that his brothers have moved on to Dothan. That's another 15 to 20 miles from Shechem to Dothan. Another 20 miles further away from home. He's almost now up to 70 miles away. Dothan in Hebrew means two wells or two cisterns. He traveled the 50 miles from Hebron to Shechem. Another 20 from Shechem to Dothan. It does say something about the 17-year-old who carries out his responsibilities even when it was more than was originally asked of him. He was asked to go to Shechem and bring back a report. It would have been really easy to come back to his father and say, "Hey, they wasn't there. I couldn't find them. Send one of these servants you got up there." But he doesn't. He's seemed to be concerned for his brothers, finds out where his brothers are, and then goes to check on them. His brothers are now in Dothan. They're known, again, for its two wells in Hebrew. And we do know from later reading here that some of the wells were dry. The well they're going to throw Jacob in, the well they're going to throw Joseph in, was dry. Maybe that's why they call him Israel, so it's easier to get right here. The well they're going to throw Joseph in is dry. So likely both of them are dry. Maybe they went up there to get water, and there was no water to be found. Travel all the way up here and come up empty-handed. If that be the case, you can see where they're ticked off. You can see where they're agitated. Agitated, upset, in Dothan, away from father. And then, verse 18, they saw him from afar. They saw Joseph from afar. Likely the coat he was wearing, likely the robe he was wearing made him noticeable. They could see him on the horizon. You know, Joseph was, if I had to imagine, Joseph was going to be relieved to see his brothers. He was going to be excited to see them, glad they were alive. But the feeling's not mutual. Upon seeing him, their anger is aroused. And they quickly devise a plot to kill him. It says that when they saw him from afar, before he came to them, they conspired against him to kill him. Before he even got there, they'd already come up with this plan. We're going to kill him. Before he could even reach them, they had decided they were going to kill him. Verse 19. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer." Still fresh on their mind. In this long robe, because he had the robe on, we know this for certain. Here he comes in this robe with this symbol of authority, symbol of favoritism, with all these dreams, how he's going to reign over us. Here he comes. Again, aggravation, I'm sure. But they're given here the plans. We're given the plans on their murder. We're given the motivation because they just hate him in his dreams. It just rekindled their anger. Then we get in verse 20. "Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what becomes of his dreams." Yeah, we will see. You know, what's funny is actually their plans are actually going to lead to the fulfillment of the dreams which they hate. The dream of them bowing down to him. They hated that. But their actions are what lead to that very thing. God just works all this out. It just makes you smile when you see it. Let's read verse 21. "But when Reuben heard it," so it seems as if Reuben wasn't part of the original murder plot. Reuben heard this. "But when Reuben heard it, he said to them, 'Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, and he said this, basically, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father.'" So his goal is, don't kill him, guys. Don't shed any blood. Just throw him in this pit out in the middle of the wilderness. He'll starve to death. But his whole intention was to come back and rescue him and restore him to the father. That was Reuben's intention. But Reuben's message was, just don't shed any blood. You know, it kind of seems to just tiptoe around this thing. Basically, just let him starve to death. Even though he intended on coming back, he just tiptoes around what he's trying to say. And instead of just being bold. You know, Reuben was trying to save Joseph's life. You know, there are times when we need to be gentle with people, but this isn't the time. This isn't the time. This is life or death. You know, I could only think about that when I thought about sharing the gospel. Because the gospel is a life-saving message. You know, we do need to be gentle. We do need to be loving, but we don't need to tiptoe around the message to where we never get our point across. You know, it's so easy to do. This is life or death. Be bold. But Joseph is in this pit. And Reuben here is just kind of tiptoeing around. "Oh, just don't kill him. Just throw him in the pit. You know, he'll starve. It'll be okay." They wanted Joseph to die of starvation, and yet he would be the very one who would save them from starvation. That's something, isn't it? And then, like I said, it's just, some of this stuff is just, again, just humorous. So, they don't want to kill him. He wanted to throw him in a pit. Verse 23. "So when Joseph came to his brother, they stripped him of his robe." The robe of many colors. The long sleeve robe. The robe of many colors that he wore. "They took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it." So he wasn't going to drown. The intention there was to leave him there in the middle of the wilderness to die of starvation. Verse 25 for a little bit of humor. "Then they sat down to eat." Nothing like a murder plot or kidnapping to make a man hungry, I guess. You know, I can only just imagine this, you know, that they just wrestled the coat off their brother after they come up with this plan, threw him into a pit, and make no mistake, he was begging for his life, and they just sit down to eat. I'm hungry. You hungry? Then they sat down to eat. All the while, hearing their brothers cry for help. Sometimes we read this and you just get the opinion that they grab Joseph. Oh, guys, please don't do this. They throw him in a pit. Oh, please don't do this. But that's not what happened. Look in chapter 40. Well, I'll read it. Chapter 42, verse 21. Again, when his brothers are before Joseph, they don't know it's him. They say this. Then they said to one another, 42:21, in truth we are guilty concerning our brother, talking about Joseph. We saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. Look, he was distressed in soul. He was begging them not to do this. Why are you doing this? They didn't listen because they hated him. They hated him so much. And they just simply go on with their life, eating on the heels of this. They sat down to eat. And then they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh, and his brothers listen to him. Well, just notice the compassion of Judah. Look, if we kill him, ain't no profit in that. What'd you say we sell him? We make some money off this deal. I mean, oh man, his brothers, less guilt is what they thought, more to gain by selling Joseph. So they're going to go in verse 28. Then the Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. So, I can only wonder, when they grabbed Joseph and drug him out of the pit, was he relieved? Did he think his brothers had a change of heart? They were just trying to teach him a lesson. Maybe they're playing a bad, mean prank. No. He's fixing to be sold to Egypt as a slave. They deemed it best not to kill him. I got to give them credit for that. Shed no blood. But it's not that they wanted him out of their life. Killing would do the job, but there's no money in that. Let's just sell him. 30 shekels of silver. Then we read in verse 29. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes. They returned to his brothers and said, the boy is gone, and where shall I go? Again, quit tiptoeing around the point, Reuben. Tell him what you think. Don't tell him to throw him in the pit so he dies, and then they have a change of mind, and you're all tore up about it. Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, this we have found. Please identify whether this is your son's robe or not. And he identified it and said, it is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph, it was without doubt, torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, no, I shall go down to Sheol to my son, mourning. Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him, Joseph, in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. So, again, verse 31, he's gone. What shall I do? How are we going to tell his father? No big deal. We still got his coat. What we'll do is we'll go slaughter a goat. We'll dip the robe in blood, and we'll just say he was, you know, slaughtered by some wild beast. Again, irony, if you remember chapter 27, Jacob himself slaughtered a goat and took its skin to deceive his father, right? Remember, he put it on his arms to deceive his father, so because he had smooth skin. Here, his sons are going to slaughter a goat and use its blood to deceive him. Sometimes we reap what we sow. But then they go, they slaughter this goat, dip this robe in blood, take it to Jacob, and then they say this: "We have found this. Please identify it. Is this your son's robe or not?" Your son. That's not our brother. Is this your son's robe? They knew it was. But there's no concern. They still are not showing any concern for this. Not, "Oh, Jacob, is this our brother's robe?" You don't see that. What you see is in one hand they hold the robe, dipped in the blood of a goat aimed to deceive their father. In the other hand, they held the money in which they had sold their brother into slavery. They watch, they listen as their father and their sisters mourn. All this with the cries of Joseph so fresh in their mind. His distress of soul. He begged them. Scripture says they remembered that. He begged them. This is just cold. This is callous. This is hate. This is a fruit of hatred. It's a result of unrestrained envy, unrestrained jealousy. Even the perfect man, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, was crucified out of envy. We need to guard our hearts. You know, we live in a society that encourages envy. You know, it's very common to see a commercial and it shows, for instance, you're a quote-unquote boss on a boat. And you want to be like your boss. You want what your boss has. And that's the whole goal of the commercial. Guard our hearts. Because we easily could get this hatred and have it just build and fester and actually turn into jealous or envy here. And actually ended up in what they thought was the murder of their brother or the kidnapping of their brother. But it goes on and tells us in verse 36, all this mourning, meanwhile, verse 36, while the family is mourning, Joseph is sold to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh. The Lord never lost sight of Joseph. The Lord was putting him in a place, sending him ahead of them to preserve life. They meant it for evil. God meant it for good. God's hand is all in this. So, just some thoughts to kind of close on here. God had told them that they would be slaves in a foreign land. Now we know that's going to be Egypt for 400 years. He told them through dreams they would actually bow down to Joseph. And with one act, they set in motion the very events that fulfill this. Just a question in my mind, would they ever have bowed down to Joseph if he hadn't been a ruler in Egypt? It seems unlikely. But their actions are what the Lord used to fulfill the very prophecy they hated. And you take all this and you overlay with it the promises of Genesis 15, how while they're in Egypt, that the Lord was being patient with the Amorites, giving them 400 years to repent. And then when he brought Israel back into the land he was going to give them and they judged the Amorites, God was just in doing so. And giving Israel the land, he's actually fulfilling the promise he had made to Abram also. Notice everything that's going on and know the Lord is sovereign over every single step. It's the fool who says in his heart there is no God. But it's a sinner who says they want to be God. So we have here, again, Joseph, 17 years old. His mother's dead. His sister's been raped. His brothers have murdered all the men in Shechem. His older brother committed incest. All his brothers hate him. They considered killing him, but there was no money in that. So they sold him as a slave, never to be seen again. What makes you think your life is so bad that God can't use you? Has someone offended you to a point where forgiveness is off the table? Really? After all this? You know, Joseph still forgives his brothers. Without them asking, by the way. As bad as Joseph was treated, this still pales in comparison to the way they treated Jesus. You know, it's easy to shake our fist at the Romans or the Pharisees, but if we're honest, we would have been right there to drive those nails in His hand. We'd have been right there with Him. Look, nobody's wronged you as much as you've wronged Jesus. Nobody's even wronged you as much as Joseph was wronged. And with all these examples of Jesus and Joseph, and there's multiple more, there's no basis to have an unforgiving spirit. There's no scriptural example we have of having an unforgiving spirit. So let's follow the example of forgiveness that Joseph displays, that Jesus so clearly had. Notice, let's not follow the path of His brothers who were unwilling to forgive. Let's take notice of the dangers of jealousy and hate. And let's know that God can even use the sinful acts of men for His glory. If you would please stand.